Hello everybody, my name is Kajsa Krawczyk. I'm in Starbucks at Leiden Central Station in Netherlands with Professor Vasilis Karakassis, researcher and lecturer at the Hague University of Applied Science. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Today we're going to talk about the issues of Cyprus, Republic of Cyprus, Cyprus. That's a controversial topic. We'll get into that. But first of all, I'm curious why this topic is special for you, both personally and academically.
So, some background could actually help you understand why I'm that much interested in this subject. I'm a son of a Greek diplomat, and I was really interested in Greek foreign policy. For Greek foreign policy, the two most important items is the dispute in the Aegean and the Cyprus conflict. Both of them evolve around Turkey. So, from the very beginning, you know, when I was 15, 16 years old, I was trying to dive into newspapers and see what is happening, understand the background. Still, had a much more fragmented and disjointed view of the situation. I studied political science and public administration. The prospect for me was to, the prospect that I had set for myself, right, was to become a diplomat as well. And I knew that this kind of subjects were the most important ones. So I finished political science, public administration. Then I had a master's in international relations in Turkey, but with focus on Greek-Turkish relations. And then I had a master's at Leiden University on crisis and security management. So trying to merge, let's say, content-wise, the messages that I drew from the master's was the Cyprus conflict. And of course, nothing works linear in the entire process. How did I come up with this topic? So during my second master's, I came across former Minister of Defense of the Netherlands, Joris Voorhoeven. He was running a course called Peace Building After Conflict. At that moment, my main, consideration was to deliver a project that I was feeling familiar with, the conflict in Palestine. And he told me, no, I know your background. You have studied in Turkey. You are Greek. I want you to perform a presentation on the Cyprus conflict. I said, okay. He assigned to me a 10 out of 10, which, you know, for the Dutch standards, that's, you know, pretty hard. And I said, okay, there should be something there. And after we finished the masters, he gave me the possibility to give some lectures on this topic. And you know, when you learn something, when you're about to teach it. So I was studying more and more on this subject, and that's why it became the main area of interest. I was applying for PhDs. I got rejected many times. Different proposals got rejected. And then my supervisor told me, you know something, we could start this for free. You'll not get any funding, but you can find a job and you can work complementarily to your PhD. And this is how I actually started the PhD, and this is why I got engaged with the conflict.
Okay, so maybe let's dive into the content of your area of interest. I think the main question that everybody that hears about the situation in Cyprus is why this island is divided.
So while there are 1,400,000 people, probably even more, residing on the islands, and we have also different national groups, the key players are two: the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots. And the reason why the island is divided is a bit, some people would say complicated, some other people would say simplistic. Let me start with the following assumption. Cyprus is not a conflict that has not drawn international attention. There have been multiple interventions. The United Nations has been there since 1964 through a peacekeeping mission, but also there have been many diplomatic efforts in order to bridge the gap between the two sides. We're going to discuss about the positions of the two sides afterwards. But the reason why there's no settlement, no solution, can be identified in multiple factors. The first one is a mismatch between what the international community wants from the Cyprus conflict and what the people want. So, as an international community, you need quick fixes. Cyprus is located at the crossroads of three continents. It is a quite a crucial geopolitical spot, and that's why it's quite important for the international community to settle this type of conflict as quickly as possible. On the other hand, the people that live on the island, the grassroots, do not want just quick fixes. They need justice, whatever justice means to them. So when you have this kind of trade-off between efficiency, getting the job done, and justice or legitimacy, and there's a trade-off, and you cannot strike a proper balance between these two, then you have an issue. The second reason is the absence of what academics call mutually hurting stalemate. After the 1974 events, which we can talk about later, both sides have learned how to live with their wounds. And probably they seem okay with the situation. Although they don't want to say this out loud, we know that this division is an anomaly. We cannot actually say that we can accept this. Still, people are okay with it. Cyprus is no Gaza. Cyprus is no Kashmir. It's not a conflict where you have people losing their lives day by day. It's a conflict that has been consolidated in the consciousness of the people. There have been no casualties, no fatalities, and you know, people have learned to live in this anomaly. So the cost of changing this might outweigh the benefits of the solution, at least from their own viewpoint. Plus, the grievances that both sides hold do not make them that eager to actually let them go for the sake of a peace that might not satisfy their needs. There's also a third reason. I mean, from the at least Greek Cypriot point of view, is the position of Turkey. What do I mean by that? Right now in the island, there are 35,000 troops from Turkey. From Turkish perspective, if you gain something through war, you cannot give it up through peace negotiations. So this type of status quo, and in the mindset of the Turkish elite, probably the conflict has been resolved. Although Turkey has exhibited either, I don't know if it's an honest position or not, so this is another question, they have shown that they are open to other solutions. I think that in the Turkish mindset, the issue has been resolved since 1974. So that's why these three reasons, in my opinion, are the ones that keep the island divided.
Maybe let's dive into the history of this issue, because when I was reading about it, I noticed that it was a pretty long clash of empires in that region. First, it was a part of Ottoman Empire, then British came in. What's the story here?
You know, this is what an archaeologist could address, so I'm not quite sure. But I think that we have some residents already from the Neolithic period. But Cyprus has witnessed the entrance of the presence of civilizations like the Achaeans, the Mycenaeans, the Arcadians. So, and these aspects show that there has been a Greek identity on the island, because all these tribes were Greek-speaking tribes. The Turkish element started entering Cyprus after 1571. From 1571 until 1878, Cyprus was under the Ottoman Empire. And during that moment, you have both the Turkish character, but also the Muslim character of some parts of the island. And after 1878, when we had the Great Eastern Question, meaning that we had the losses of the Ottoman territory from Russia, the Ottoman Empire found itself in an extremely difficult position, and what they had to do was that in order to get some guarantees about the defense of their borders, they had to strike a deal with the British. And the British told them that, okay, we're going to help you defending your borders, but in exchange, you're going to give us the administration of Cyprus. It will not be the sovereignty of Cyprus, it will be the administration. What's the difference? The difference is the taxation, because the taxes would go back to the Sultan, to the Ottoman Empire. But the way the domestic affairs would run would be through the British. So this development was interpreted by the Greeks at that moment, who were residing on the island, as the golden opportunity in order to pursue their aspirations. And their aspirations were to unify the islands with Greece. Although this was never the case, of course, Cyprus was part of the Eastern Roman Empire, but this doesn't mean that Eastern Roman Empire was also a multicultural empire. It had also strong Greek element, but it was not just a Greek element. So at that moment, this is how many Greek residents interpreted this this development. But of course, this was not well appreciated by the other part of the island, the Turkish Cypriots, that were still considering the Tori Teori as part of the Ottoman Empire. Of course, things have changed since then, after 1878, because in 1923 we have the Lausanne Treaty. The Lausanne Treaty was the one meant the establishment of the Turkish Republic on the one hand, but also the recognition of the Greek-Turkish borders, as well as the fact that Turkey would cede Cyprus to the British, and they would revoke any claims on the island. So still, the British had never given any kind of sign that they would be willing to give up Cyprus for the Greeks.
Why was it important for the British? Because you mentioned that the region is located in a really strategic position, but why was it particularly important for the British?
If you check, you know, the British had this mentality of letting Central Europe being the prey of the German-French competition, the antagonism, but what they wanted to control was the seas. So if you see back then, British were controlling, let's say, Malta, they were controlling Gibraltar, they were controlling this kind of choke points that will help them control the flow of the trades. They were a naval empire, so that's why for them, they wanted to have access to basic choke points. And Cyprus was one of them. Because if we check on the location of Cyprus, it is close to Egypt, close to the Red Sea, which is an important transit route from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean. So for the British, having access and monitoring the situation there was quite important.
And if we have British on the agenda right now, their rule over Cyprus ended at some point.
To some extent. So that's a good point. So the British realized, because what happened, that since the British were not eager to negotiate with Greece any possibility of the unification of Cyprus with Greece, we had some guerrilla activities on the island that were somehow supported also by Greece. And this would be a big issue, especially after 1952, when Greeks joined the NATO. Many people would assume that Greeks would not join an antagonism against the British, but at that moment, the aspirations spiraled out of control. So the British resorted to something they're quite familiar with in many other areas, like the Kashmir, like the Middle East, and this is the divide and rule. They brought back Turkey into the game. So what they were doing was trying to create coalitions with the Turkish Cypriots, expose Turkish Cypriots to the dangers that the British would suffer in general, in principle, and somehow drag Turkey into the Cyprus issue. So that's why they created a tripartite conference in 1955, which signaled the re-involvement of Turkey in the Cyprus affairs, although this was something that Turkey had revoked from the Lausanne Treaty in 1923.
In 1955, that's the period in history where European empires collapse. French, British, they lose the majority of their colonies. Cypriot people decided to push for the independence. Can you tell us more about the civil war? Can I call it like that?
To some extent, because it was actually an independence war. It was in 1952, indeed, that we had the Suez Crisis. And I think this signaled the fact that the British were not the empire they used to be in the past. So for them, I think that the Cyprus issue was not only about safeguarding the choke points that would help them control the flow of the trade, but was also an ego issue, an issue of their pride. Of course, you could see that the positions of the Labour Party and the Tories was quite different. The Labour was always a bit more eager to discuss the possibilities of ceding the island to Greeks, but the Tories had a much more intransigent policy. So when the Greek Cypriots realized that the British were not eager to support the claims, they start an armed struggle. Of course, this started 2 decades ago, in 1931, indicatively. They burned, they put in flames the British governance house in Cyprus. This was already a message that, look, we don't recognize you here. The British, on the other hand, feared that this kind of moves would have also a political element. And the political element was not only the Greek nationalism, but also the involvement of the communists.
I mean, it was Cold War, so it was pretty intense back in the 50s.
I cannot say that it was just, also the communists participated, but it was quite difficult to the communists to capitalize it, that it was somehow supported by the Soviet Union. I think that the Soviet Union had a much more hands-off policy because they were treating Cyprus as a Western issue that they don't want to get involved. But of course, if they thought that this would provide them with a golden opportunity to get involved, they will not lose it. But of course, there was no actually sign that Soviet Union would more actively involved. So that's why we need to see the situation as part of the Cold War, because if we detach it, then we cannot understand the British obsession as well as the American involvement in the region. So we had guerrilla fights, but these guerrilla fights were targeting British, not Turkish Cypriots. But on the other hand, for the British, they were actually hiring and recruiting a lot of Turkish Cypriots policemen, so they would put them at the forefront, they would put them in danger, and in this case, they would actually justify the claim that Turkey should be involved.
And what was the result of all that? What were the long-term consequences of the independence war?
I think in 1955, we have this call for, we had this referendum about the unification. The Turkish Cypriots were fully against it, but they felt that they were, that their considerations were not taken into account. So this felt, you know, this left a feeling of vulnerability to the Turkish Cypriots, and involving Turkey was a primary aspect of their agenda. So for them, it would be quite unthinkable to consider the architecture of Cyprus without the involvement of Turkey. While this was not for granted before. For the Turkish Cypriots, this involved also of what we call a Crete syndrome. What do I mean by that? Back in 1866, 1869, Creta was not part of the Greek state. It was under the Ottoman Empire, and Greeks revolted. And they made Creta, after decades, in 1913, part of the state of Greece. So this historical memory, many people that were living there were Turkish Cretans. This kind of memory remained in them. And they feared that if they don't do something, or Turkey is not getting actively involved, then history is going to repeat itself. So therefore, this kind of impact, this kind of Crete syndrome, had left its scar on them, and that's why it's quite important to see Turkish involvement. So this was an enduring impact on the Turkish Cypriots' perception vis-a-vis both the Greek Cypriots and Greeks. On the other hand, when it comes to the Greek Cypriots, the passion for the unification was strong, but it was appeased a couple of years ago, in 1959, when we have the gathering in the Zurich and London Agreement, where we had the leaders of Greece, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. They gathered in Zurich and then in London, and they created a new constitution for Cyprus.
Yeah, that constitution, I read that it was one of the most complicated constitutional acts in the world, because they had to take into account the interests of two groups, which one of them was clearly a minority in the country. And was this constitution, they thought it would work? Or from the beginning they knew that, yeah, it can go to different direction?
It is a good question. And the question is whether they prioritize the sustainability and the viability of this constitution, or whether they wanted efficiency, quick fixes. Because at that moment, the British, who had lost their grip with the situation on the island, they just wanted to guarantee they will have access to two bases on the island, Akrotiri and Dekelia, and they still have those. So this was the only thing they cared about. When it came to the functionality of the system, I don't think they put a lot of attention to this. They just wanted, on the one hand, to somehow satisfy the Greek Cypriot demands, as the majority of the island. They were representing around 80% of the population of the island, and they had to somehow provide some safeguards to the 14% of the island, the Turkish Cypriots. That's why they came with this kind of complicated, I would call it neocolonial, institutional framework that would satisfy the demands of both sides. But the main problem of this was that both Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots were not actively involved in the drafting of this constitution. It was Greece, it was Turkey, and it was the UK. But it was not the Greek Cypriot leader, it was not the Turkish Cypriot leader. Probably they were consulted, but they were not part of the agreement. And you have this kind of paradox, especially articulated in the Treaty of Guarantee, that for the sovereignty of this new country, of this new state, it will not be the Cypriots, but it will be the three guarantor powers.
It wasn't a sovereign state.
It was not, exactly. So it's actually the very concept of sovereignty is undermined. Imagine, for instance, let's take a country, let's say with the case of Ukraine. I don't know what kind of security architecture we will have in the future, but imagine that they might say, okay, for the sovereignty of Ukraine, you know, after a conflict, after, you know, the Russian invasion, responsible will be Russia, China, Turkey, UK, Germany, anybody but Ukraine. So in this case, is it, can we still talk about sovereignty? In my opinion, no. Sovereignty is up from the barbarian. The state has the monopoly of power. They have the monopoly of violence. So if this monopoly goes to the hands of somebody else, then the very notion of sovereignty is undermined.
Okay, let's come back to the topic. I asked you this question about constitution, even though that it was kind of a rhetorical question, because 3 years later, in 1963, the first escalation between Turkish yes. Cypriots and Greek Cypriots collapsed.
Indeed, what happened was that the first president of Cyprus, Makarios, the Archbishop, he was actually the one that ran the referendum back in 1955. He raised 14 points in order to amend the constitution in favor of the Greek Cypriots, but also providing some extra safeguard to the Turkish Cypriots. Both Turkish Cypriots and Turkey rejected them, and there were tensions, and these tensions spiraled out of control in 1963, when in one control that the police forces, the Greek Cypriot police forces, were in some controls of IDs of two Turkish Cypriots, some gunshots started, people gathered, and the situation spiraled out of control. It spiraled out of control to that extent that Turkish Cypriots de facto withdrew from the government. They had they created some enclaves. This was actually a first sign that they will not be part of the Republic of Cyprus. So it was kind of secession.
And that was escalation between the inhabitants of the island. But in 1974, Greece and Turkey joined the party, we can say like that.
Indeed. So this needs some kind of historical background, because the constitution, the 1959, would give 950 troops for the Greeks, 650 troops for the Turks, the guarantor powers. Nonetheless, these numbers were just on paper, because in the reality, both Greeks and Turks have bigger powers. But the biggest the vast majority of the troops belong to the Greeks. So the Greeks had a bigger grip on the security of the island than the Turks. Because of this escalation in 1964, the United Nations said, look, you have to go back to the original figures. And Greeks withdrew their troops, but Turks did not withdraw the troops. So this changed the balance of power on the island in Turkey's favor. And what happened was that, of course, also the proximity of the island to Turkey. It's really closer than Greece is to Cyprus, and this is quite important for the development afterwards. So in 1967, Greece, after many years of political instability, had the rise of junta, a military dictatorship. And the military dictatorship wanted to get rid of the Archbishop Makarios, on the grounds that he was considered a communist, or on the grounds that probably they could not exert control on him. It is questionable whether the junta wanted a war against Turkey. I think, based on the documents that I've read, this was not their intention. Nonetheless, the issue was, and this was part of the clause of the Treaty of the Guarantees, if there is an external danger against the security of the island, then one of the three guarantor powers could unilaterally and militarily intervene in order to restore the situation to normality. You can understand that this clause, if interpreted in a la carte, could trigger many challenges. And this challenge came in 1974, because the junta, while trying to get rid of Archbishop Makarios, somehow made Turkey invoke this particular clause. Turkey said, oh, there is a security issue in the island, I had to intervene.
So every single little type of intervention into the country's administration system was pictured by the other side as a breach of the negotiations efforts. And that's why Turkey decided to intervene.
In 1974, this is the way they justified. They thought that there is a security threat and we don't want to leave the Turkish Cypriots as a prey to the Greek military junta and to the Greek Cypriots, to the guerrilla fighters. So that's why we have to militarily intervene. And the problem is that they intervened, they occupied 10% of the island in the beginning, and then when the negotiation started and the junta had crumbled and it was replaced by a democratic government of Karamanlis, they had a second intervention. And that's why, for me, both interventions are invasions. Of course, this term is used by the Greek Cypriots, by the Greeks. I think also there are international organizations that call it invasion. But the Security Council calls it foreign military intervention. And they call it in such a way, asking the countries to withdraw the troops from the island. So Turkey made the invasion in 1974. They occupied 36.2% of the island. And since then, we live in that situation. Nonetheless, I have to say the line that divides the island, it's a 183 kilometers buffer zone, has started back in 1963, 1964. It was actually, they used that particular line as the buffer zone, as the division line.
You're talking about the green line.
The green line.
I know the genesis of the name is that British general draw a green line on the map.
In a scenographic, exactly. Yeah, so this is actually, but what happened was that we had a kind of consolidation of this, and full of border controls. It was impossible to move from the one side to the other for many years, until 2003. And of course, we had the worst part was the one, not only, we didn't have only 2,000 people that died. The problem is what followed afterwards, because Turkey breached the Geneva Conventions and started Turkifying the island. So they were bringing settlers from Anatolia to the island. And this changed also the character, the Cypriot character of the island. Also another thing was that the properties that belonged to the Greek Cypriots would be resided by either the Turkish Cypriots or by settlers. This has had a lasting impact. So this development has left its scars on the island.
So that's the clue of the whole issue that is going on right now. I would like to move on to more modern aspects of that issue. But before we start talking about EU accession, there is a gap of like 20 years in between, from the 74 to 2004, 30 years
yes.
even. So what happened in that period?
There have been multiple efforts. So in 1977, we had the first effort for a bicommunal, bizonal federation. And there would be territorial adjustments between the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots, but the idea would be to create a federation. And under the federation, you would have two federated states. Leaving the British bases aside, they will not change their status. That would be the logic. This is the kind of the blueprint for many other negotiations that started back then. So this was in 1977. Nonetheless, this solution was not accepted by Greek Cypriots because they thought that they would legalize the invasion of Turkey. The problem was that when you leave the situation unsettled, then the motivation to resolve the situation are lessened as the time passed. And in 1983, we had something that was kind of a bold move that has no legal consequences yet. So what happened was that the Turkish Cypriot leader, Rauf Denktaş, decided to declare the independence of the state of the so-called Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. So in this case, to actually create a new state. Nonetheless, no country in the world, except for Turkey, has recognized it as a state. So there are no embassies in that area. And of course, this complicated things a lot for the to reach a settlement. Because the idea for Denktaş probably was to put the status of the Turkish Cypriots on the same level like the Greek Cypriots. Because one common thing, common fear animating many Turkish Cypriots vis-a-vis the Turkish Cypriots was that they were being treated as a minority, not as an equal community, due to the demographic aspects of the island, since the Greek Cypriots were the majority. So there's complicated things. There were no serious initiatives back in 1980s. Things have started changing in 1990s, because in 1990 was the time when the Republic of Cyprus, administered by the Greek Cypriots, applied to the EU after push, after support by both Greece and Great Britain. The initial stance of the EU was quite cautious, that you didn't want a tickling bomb on
board.
Exactly. And they said in the beginning was, you know, if you actually reach a settlement along the lines of the United Nations Security Council resolutions, which were calling also from Turkey to withdraw its troops from the island, then in this case, we would discuss this. However, as time passed, in 1999, we had a breakthrough. It was the Helsinki Council, and it was decided back then that if Turkey wanted, expressed its desire to become a member of the EU, and this was the breakthrough. However, it was told to Turkey that if you want to do that, then you need to change your stance on the Cyprus issue. You cannot leave your troops there. An important element, the Greeks managed to convince the EU that Cyprus could become a member of the EU regardless of whether a settlement would be reached. So far, the discourse was that the reason why we do not have a settlement in Cyprus was Turkey and its intransigent stance, the fact that it was keeping its troops, the fact that it was bringing in settlers. This was the narrative also in the EU. So that's why the Greek position was, you know, something you cannot actually punish the victim for this situation. However, the Greeks, I assume, played also another card. From 1999 until 2004, we had an important project for the EU, which was the enlargement. And when it comes to the decision-making on this enlargement, it's not just a supranational aspect where you have an ordinary legislative process where you say, okay, absolute majority in the parliament and absolute majority in the member states. It's fully intergovernmental. And when we talk about intergovernmental, it means that even if one small country, Luxembourg, was vetoing it, then the entire enlargement will not take place. So instead of Luxembourg right now, think of Greece. Greece probably might have said to its European counterparts that if you don't accept Cyprus as it is, regardless of whether a settlement is reached, then guess what?
The whole thing collapsed. Yeah, I remember from our classes that even though EU accession process is really complicated, but when the political interest is more important than that, there can be some exceptions from the legal framework.
Exactly. So you can see that also from 2005, Austria with Croatia. Austria would actually was about to block some clusters of Turkey's accession in case Croatia would not get a deadline for its admission in the EU. Although, from a legal perspective, they could not raise such claims. But still, sometimes, many times actually, the national interest might outweigh, you know, the institutional interest of the EU. I assume that something similar happened also here. So the Greeks, I assume, because this is speculation, I have not any written evidence to support this, I assume that the Greeks might have told their European counterparts that if you don't accept Cyprus as it is, not on the condition of a settlement, then the whole big bang will be vetoed by us. That would be a huge blow for EU strategy. A strategy that was not hammered out in 1-2 years. It was a strategy after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. It was from the very beginning. So imagine what could have happened if the strategy would fail because one member state...
Yeah, 15 years of diplomatic efforts for nothing.
Exactly.
And was the EU accession process seen in Cyprus as a possibility for reunification?
So the right momentum, it was perceived as such. There was a right momentum because you had Turkey that expressed a desire to become a member of the EU and they had to conform to the requirements of the EU. But think about this. You are Greek Cypriot and you're given a date. And you're given a date regardless of whether a settlement is going to be reached or not. Back then, the United Nations, under the auspices of its Secretary General, Kofi Annan, they drafted a plan, the so-called Annan Plan, that would create a Swiss, or yeah, I would say a Swiss model of a federation with the same logic of the 1977, bi-zonal, bi-communal federation. Of course, without particular deadlines about when the troops would withdraw, this was actually an issue. And also there were issues about the compensation of about the properties. There were some problematic issues, but it was a plan about the unification of Cyprus. You are Greek Cypriot and you know that regardless of whether you're going to vote in favor of the plan or not, you're going to join the EU in 2004. And you're Turkish Cypriot, that if you vote against it, probably you'll be left out. You are Greek Cypriot, how would you vote?
I would vote against, because...
Exactly.
It doesn't make any difference.
Exactly, that's a key point. The so-called carrot of conditioning the EU admission on the resolution of the Cyprus conflict was lost.
So the process was totally independent from the actual situation.
Exactly. So the Greek Cypriots, I think 76% of the Greek Cypriots voted against it, while 65% of the Turkish Cypriots voted in favor. Whether it were the Greek Turkish Cypriots had a genuine desire in becoming a member of the EU or resolving the Cyprus conflict is quite questionable. But also Turkey was not also a huge fan of the plan, because they had also to make some kind of concessions. But the strategy for Turkey was that right now we need to switch the narrative. We cannot be seen anymore as the bad guys, as the intransigent side. We should shift the blame towards the other ones. And this is what Turkey achieved this way. So they were not considered as the generators of the impasse. They were seen as an entity that showed its goodwill, regardless of whether this goodwill was genuine or not.
So now both sides had problems with reaching a beneficial solution for the people.
At that moment, imagine that you had this reputation of the country that made this invasion, right? You were held accountable for the situation. You have this possibility of the Annan Plan. And you know what you're saying is, you know something, vote in favor, regardless of whether you believe in the sustainability of the plan. And on the other hand, you have the Greek Cypriots saying, have a plan. I feel still badly treated by the international community. I'm not compelled to vote in favor of the plan, because if I vote against it, still I become member of the EU. So the situation was a bit problematic.
But for sure, the actual accession to the EU was beneficial for at least a part of the people. How do people there benefit? I mean, the one part, the Turkish part and Greek part, do they benefit at the same ratio?
Not on the same ratio. So the Greek Cypriots, except for the Schengen Treaty, yes, except for the Schengen Treaty with the free movement of people, because there are restrictions, when it comes to the other aspects, they are actually enjoying the benefits and they need to meet the obligations of the acquis communautaire. So they have to fully comply with European legislation. When it comes to the Turkish Cypriots, things are a bit more complicated. The EU has issued the green trade regulation, the free trade regulation about circulating goods and trade from the EU to the northern side and vice versa, but it has worked in a rather insufficient way. And the reason why it has worked in an insufficient way is because Turkish Cypriots are fully dependent on Turkey. All the structures, all the institutions are monitored by Ankara. So for instance, let's assume that you go from the Greek Cypriot side to the Turkish Cypriot one and you get a speed ticket. This speed ticket is not going to be issued by the Turkish Cypriots, it's going to be issued by Ankara, because they don't have the legal entity.
Yeah, the legal aspect is really interesting, and I think the legal framework given by the European Union can be also a part of a solution to the whole issue, because if on the European level there is a common framework for every single member state, it can dissolve the issue of, okay, we're gonna do it on our own.
Yeah. So here it's an institutional aspect. When it comes to the Greek Cypriots, it's a free market economy and they do exports, they do imports. So in this case, they could somehow survive in a competitive environment, despite the crisis also that they went through more than a decade ago. When it comes to the Turkish Cypriots, it's not a free market economy. It's an economy that relies on loans from Turkey. And in order to survive, they need to strike a 5-year deal with Turkey, and this would actually satisfy the public service of that region. So in this case, if you don't change your institutions, if you don't become a bit more market oriented, it will be extremely challenging for you to survive in this environment. And that's why you need to make step by steps in order to change the situation. The question is, are you willing to make these changes? Especially if you have learned to live with this situation for 5 decades and even more.
Yeah, I'm curious about how young people perceive the situation. For example, people like me who are 20 years old, are they like, okay, it doesn't matter at this point? Or are they really into changing things?
So I'm going to just articulate my own experiences, and I might be right, I might be wrong. I think with the exception of a couple of activists, most people don't care anymore. They are indifferent. They don't care what happens. You are Greek Cypriot, you care about your everyday life, you care about whether you have a good car, and you don't care what's happening in the northern side. And vice versa. You know that there is a stable inflow from Turkey. You find a way to manage. You survive. You have a good level of education. You don't care what happens in the southern side. So honestly, what I care, what I see is a sense of indifference. And I think that this happens because these people there have learned how to live with this situation. I call it anomaly. I think most people would call it anomaly.
But you know, for example, in Poland, after 50 years of being a communist country, people also started to learn how to live with that, how to manage their way through the day-to-day life. But also, I have this sense that people there are maybe not indifferent, but they are tired with the whole situation. There is this guy in European Parliament right now, the Cypriot elected member, Fidias. Yeah, I'm sure you're familiar with the person. What do you think about him? Because it also shows that people choose YouTuber over diplomat.
I have a more, let's say, global perspective on this. It's because people want to see something different. I think that the youth becomes depoliticized, and this is articulated in the voting of this person. There's one YouTuber. Of course, he wants to show a much more united front that, you know, we Greek Cypriots should be together with Turkish Cypriots. Yeah, this doesn't say anything to me. What I see is that the youth in general is either tired, as you mentioned it correctly, or indifferent. I wouldn't say that there is this kind of push to find, you know, to have a unified island.
And that might also be a case for educational institutions there?
Yes, so that's a very good point. So I would say that if you see the curricula of both sides, you wouldn't say that there is such thing like Cypriot identity. The Greek Cypriots are going to celebrate the parades that the Greeks are celebrating, and I assume the same works for the Turkish Cypriots with the Turkish motherland. So there is a top-down imposition of identities. It's not, has been a serious effort to have a Cypriot identity, but I think that this effort of, let's say, this platform for the Cypriot identity is appealing to a really small portion of the island. Even in terms of self-identification, it's really rare to hear someone saying, I'm a Cypriot. There is a portion that calls it like that, but the vast majority will call itself either Greek Cypriot or Turkish Cypriot. So this, of course, is the outcome of the education and how the curricula have been developed. For the Greek Cypriots, the 1974 events have led to what is known as Denksekno, I don't forget. So where you see the map of Cyprus, and 36%, the part that is on the north, in red color, like a blood. So this is part of the consciousness, this is part of the collective memory, this is...
Yeah, the division is not only geographical one, exactly, but the social, psychological one.
And of course, for the Turkish Cypriots, the events in 1964, as you correctly mentioned, they are also entrenched in their collective memory. This sense of vulnerability, this sense of feeling your prey to the aspirations of somebody else, yeah, this is something that is still part of the Turkish Cypriot consciousness. So the division is not just about the items that they put on the negotiation table, it's about the mindset of the people.
Our discussion is really, really interesting, but we're coming to an end. But for the grand finale, I have this question. In your opinion, do you see any chance, reunification? What are the future perspectives for the Cyprus as an island?
You know, this is something that I also wrote in my presentation 5 years ago, and I'm still stick to that. I was not optimistic back then, I'm not optimistic now. And the reason I'm not optimistic is because I've been to the island 5 times. I've never seen this kind of energy that would justify any optimism about the unification of the island. If you get a divorce from somebody 50 years ago, the incentives to go back with that person after 50 years is not just questionable, you would call it...
Irrational.
Exactly, you would call it irrational. And believe me, the benefits of an integration provided by the IMF, provided by the World Bank, the economic benefits per capita for the people, in case we would have a unification of the island because of the structural reforms, because of the infrastructure investments, would be extremely high for all the residents of the island. So the rational arguments about having a unified island are there. Nonetheless, the consciousness, the mindset, the motivation is something that I don't see there. And unfortunately, we have crystallized this kind of situation that I don't find viable. I think it's abnormal, but it might persist unless other scenarios might come into play. Other scenarios that might be even worse than the current scenario. You can call it an annexation of the Turkish Cypriot part by Turkey and making this part the 82nd province of Turkey. It might be a kind of recognition of the so-called Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, the self-declared entity. Although this kind of efforts of Turkey to recognize it have failed, they have tanked, and this is quite good for the Greek and the Cypriot diplomacy, still the efforts are there. So I don't know what kind of, might be another loose confederation like Bosnia or Bosnia-Herzegovina, which you have seen that it has not also worked there as well. So that's why I'm not optimistic.
Okay, so with this pessimistic approach, we come to an end. Thank you very much. I was with Vasilis Karakasis, researcher and lecturer at the Hague University of Applied Science. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time as well.